Welcome to a new episode of the Tennis Lifestyle Podcast. I'm your host, Gianluca Sola. In today's episode, I speak to Nathan Martin. He speaks to me from Sydney. We had a great chat. Nathan is a top tennis fitness coach. Together with his wife, Giselle, they have been doing this for several years, and they have trained a number of top level players, five number ones in the world, including Martina Navratilova, Monica Seles, Leighton Hewitt, Jennifer Capriati, and the list goes on. So obviously they know what they're doing. As I said, it was a great chat. Anything you want to know or find out more about Nathan and what he does is on his website. It's called tennisfitness.com. All the information is there. They use a method called the Martin Method, and he explains that on the podcast. They obviously cater not only to professionals, but all levels and all ages. So it doesn't matter sort of what level you are. I think fitness can be incorporated at any level. So they have different programs, and they can do this either online with you, or obviously you can also go to their to them directly in Sydney, and they have another branch on the Sunshine Coast. Personally, we've used some of their exercises with my two boys, and they told me that even after a few weeks they felt the difference. These exercises really helped them. So yeah, enjoy the conversation we had. He talks not only about fitness but also about tennis in Australia. And at the end, we have the rapid fire quiz. Also, please follow me, like the podcast. I'm on all platforms. I've also just started an account on Instagram. I'm pretty new to that. It's called the Tennis Lifestyle Podcast. So you can follow me there. Otherwise, you can also get in touch with me or follow me on Twitter. It's GLSOLA if you want to follow me or have anything to say. So yeah, enjoy, and ciao, bye. Hi, Nathan.
Hello.
Yep.
Yes,
hi. Can you hear me well?
Yeah, I can. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, perfect. Hi. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. I'm good, thanks. I'm looking forward to having a chat with you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot for coming on my podcast. I really appreciate it. I just want to maybe start off with a brief introduction about you, and you just tell me if I'm maybe saying it right here, but today, yeah, I've got Nathan and Nathan Martin, which together with your wife Giselle, you're the owner operators of Martin Method Tennis Fitness.
Yeah,
you can find them on tennisfitness.com, everything about them. I actually came across your website during the initial lockdown we had here in South Africa. I have two sons that play tennis, and I was just looking for some home exercises, tennis exercises to do. And I came across your website, and you started doing your seven favorite tennis exercises that the pro player. That you use with the pro players.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we've got the ladder, the medicine ball, skipping and cones and all that, but we've actually continued with those because they're nice and simple, but also my son said they're very effective. So
oh great.
Yeah. They were very, very useful. You offer programs for all levels and ages. You can do them online or personally at your branches. You work out of Sydney, and I believe also is it Sunshine Coast?
Yes, that's correct.
I see. Also, you've got a team, so you've got everything. You've got obviously yourself, your wife. You've got a tennis trainer, a physiotherapist, nutritionist, a few people, which obviously means you give a total professional service. And the very exciting thing I see is that you've actually trained a lot of top tennis players, including Navratilova, Seles, Capriati, Leighton Hewitt, Arantxa Sanchez, and that's just to name a few. So that obviously
That's
must
correct.
make you one of the top tennis fitness trainers in the world.
Oh, who knows? I guess we just do what we do and we try to do it as well as we can. And yeah, we just try to help as many people as we can. And if that gets you to the top of the totem pole, then that's a bonus, I guess.
Okay. No, that's great. But yeah, to start off, how did you get into tennis and tennis fitness? Is it something you've always been into?
Look, I've always, Giselle and I are always extremely active. We met when we were in our late teens, and we were both involved in the fitness industry at the time. Giselle always had a passion to work with tennis players, and she was a very good athlete herself. She played internationally in her sport. And I competed in a lot of sports as well. So we were both sports mad. We were both were trainers. And for some reason, she just had this passion to work with tennis players. And if you ever know my wife, you'll know that she once she sets her mind on something, she'll always make it happen one way or another.
Okay.
And eventually she ended up getting some work with Arantxa Sanchez Vicario in the late 90s. And this manifested into, I guess, where we are today. It was
Okay.
just been a very enjoyable journey. And yeah, we've met a lot of people along the way, and yeah, we've basically just, I wouldn't say we fell into the industry. We worked hard to get there, but we landed on top straight away, which was a blessing looking back on it now, because it's very hard to get in on the tour. And we started at the top with not much experience working with tennis players. So yeah, it was interesting how it happened, but we definitely made the most of it.
So you were never a tennis player. So you didn't play tennis growing up, or you were never really.
No,
No.
no,
Okay.
no. We played socially, but I never played in a tennis tournament in my life.
Okay.
And I think that in some regard, I think that's been a good thing, because the sports that Giselle and I have played, they heavily cross over into tennis. So we got to understand, look at tennis from the outside looking in, and then be able to use our skill sets and the training we'd done for other sports to come in with a slightly different approach rather than just doing the conventional style of training. And I think that's sort of what set us apart our whole
Okay.
careers.
Okay. Great. And so, yeah, so what is the, I mean, briefly, because I'm sure it could be very complicated, but what is the Martin method?
Yeah. Well, look, the Martin method's a combination of things. It's a system that we've created from a training perspective, whereby we have it structured a certain way. So in a nutshell, I'll explain it to you nice and quick and for the listeners. So
Yeah.
it's a comprehensive system, the Martin method, the training side of things. So we have our basically like what we call like our morning rituals. So getting athletes up, getting them breathing, getting them in the right mindset. So what we call, we try to get them into what we call a peak state. And then after that, it's doing some mobility. So getting the body, mobility consists of getting the body moving through certain ranges of movements, so opening up multiple joints through the same movement. That just helps to lubricate the joints, increase circulation, and open up what we call the kinetic chain, so the way the body moves. And that this those combination of those things just sets the platform for the day. And then when we're training our athletes, we use what we call our nine threads. So our nine threads consist of nine different ways that we think that athletes should be able to perform and feel. And so we try to combine majority of those threads into a weekly program for players.
Okay.
So, you know, looking at things like, you know, multi-directional movement, unilateral power, what we call bilateral strength, total body flexibility. So we try to combine the nine threads into a weekly plan for players, and they would fulfill those that session or that training plan through the day. So they might complete a strength session, which would fulfill one of the nine threads. And then their post-session or post-practice or post-match, we have our recovery protocols, which consist of, you know, foam rolling, stretching, and then finishing off the day doing some breathing techniques. So all those things there, they sort of all combine to the actual physical side of the Martin method. Mm. And then the other component is the education.
Okay.
So we work, you mentioned before, we work with players. Well, people can buy a program online from us, and they just basically buy it, they download it. It's like an information program. They follow the exercises, etc., but they don't have direct contact with us. So we also offer personalized programs online, and that's the chance for people. And this is more for people who are really trying to get to that next level. It doesn't matter their age, level of tennis that they play, or their physical capabilities. We offer that for everybody because we don't discriminate, so to speak, against people who are good or who aren't good, because that's just a matter of opinion. We try to offer the service to everyone that wants to try to get as much as they can out of themselves.
Yeah.
And during that process, so we have a couple of options for people to work with doing that, and people can check it out on our website. We basically, during that time, we find the needs. So what's the want of the person? What's their goal? What's stopping them from getting it? So we look at their training history, injuries, what would stop them from achieving their goal, and then we just start to work away from there. And that's generally quite a large educational process for players going through that, where they really work out with us different things, the things that they probably wouldn't realize are going to stop them from achieving what they want to achieve. It's really once we ask them a lot of questions and get to look at their schedule and get to look at their history, and we start to pick apart what's really going on with them and what's holding them back. And a lot of times people are blown away. A lot of times we just make small changes, just create the realization of the reality of what they're doing, and we get some big breakthroughs just from doing that. So yeah, they're the sort of components of the Martin method. There's the training aspect, and then there's the educational side of it also.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is, I wanted to get your opinion on this because, fitness in tennis, this is my opinion, but I said this also before in my podcasts. There was a very famous player, number one in the world, called Ferrero from Spain. And he always, I remember his quote saying, you know, tennis, if you have to describe it, it's 50% physical, 45% mental, and 5% hitting a ball. More or less, that's what he said. You know, I mean, so so it kind of stuck in my mind. And being somebody who plays tennis and have, you know, sons who play tennis and I follow it, I've kind of realized that fitness really is so crucial in tennis. People still, I find, sort of don't give it that much importance, probably up to a certain level. But what I found interesting is there must have been a point in the history of tennis. I grew up playing tennis in the 80s and 90s. And in those periods, you know, I was sort of the end of McEnroe, Connors. It was the era of Lendl, Becker, Edberg, Willander, and the start of Agassi. That sort of period there. If you went and looked and asked how these tennis players trained their fitness, it was, and how I also as a junior did it, it was basically they would say, well, run around the field, go and swim some laps, do some push-ups, stuff like that. I mean, Lendl was maybe the only one doing a little bit more specific things, but do you know when exactly it started becoming more specific? Was there somebody who made it like that, or
I know in Australia it was in Australia. I'm not sure if you've heard of Harry Hopman.
Well,
so Harry Hopman was
Sorry to interrupt you. I actually grew up in Bologna, Italy, where they had the only Harry Hopman center in Europe, and that's where I went to play.
So for the listeners out there, I mean, Harry's Mr. Hopman, as the players all still call him. He's my idol. So I don't think many other trainers in the world would know who he is. But so for those listeners out there, he was a player himself before there was professional tennis. So it was only amateur.
Sorry to interrupt you. He's maybe the people know him as there's the Hopman Cup, or there was the Hopman Cup.
So he was a player, and he had a pretty good career, but he was more well known for his coaching, and even most players would always say that he wasn't the most technical coach. Like, he wouldn't help you much with too much with your technique, but he had the capacity to get a lot of – he demanded respect, and he demanded commitment, and he demanded hard work. And I think if you combine those three things in any job or any aspect of life, I think you're going to get success if you've got people that care about you around you. And I think that's just what he did. He had a real simple formula, and it was highly successful. I mean – he must have produced players, and there must be, I don't know, maybe nearly 50 Grand Slams that he was a part of as a coach. And if you look at some old, there's not much footage around, but the footage that there is of him training people, it was all quite robust, quite full-on training. And probably the coach that I regard as the best of all time is Tony Roach. And Tony and I worked together for a decade training players. And Tony, I interviewed him a few years ago, and he was talking about Mr. Hopman, and he said, you know, he taught you about life. That, I mean, Tony was in his late 60s at the time, early 70s, and he still called him Mr. Hopman, even though obviously Harry's passed away. But that was still the respect that he had from him. And in my opinion, you know, training started back then in Australia, and I think Australians generally after that era had quite a high work ethic. I mean, you look at your Pat Rafters, your Wally Masseurs, your McNamees, your McNamaras, all those guys, and then obviously through to your Leighton Hewitts.
I was going to ask you this question later, but one of the questions was going to be, why do you think historically Australia has produced so many good players? Do you think it started because of Hopman, and or is there like combination of reasons there?
I think it was the culture that, you know, when you look back at that era, there was You know, there was Rod Laver. I mean, there was so many, you know, Australia was such a dominant force in, I mean, you look at Margaret Court. I mean, no one's won more Grand Slams than her. Yeah. You know, singles, doubles and mixed, there's no one close to her. And I mean, Martina Navratilova's pretty, you know, she's there as well, obviously. But
yeah.
Australia was just such a dominant era. And I think a part of it was because tennis probably wasn't as big as it is now in you know, other countries around the world, particularly like Asia and Europe in the Eastern Bloc. And I think now the sport spread a lot through the 60s, 70s and 80s.
So there's more competition.
It's a lot more competition now. But, yeah, look, that era definitely spearheaded the work ethic and the game of tennis in Australia. And it's definitely, I think Leighton was probably the last of that breed of player and that breed of that mindset. And I even think though, it's a generational thing as well.
Even though, to be honest, I think Deminar is reminds me a lot of Hewitt.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, he's a little bit. Yeah, definitely. But I still think there's still a bit of a gap between. I mean, Alex obviously works hard and the rest of it, but I don't know if he lives and breathes tennis like those players used to.
Okay. No.
Yeah, there's so many other distractions, you know, social media and you know, they just get caught up with other things. There's a lot more distraction. Where back in the day, they just lived and breathed tennis. They, you know, you could get on the phone and ring your partner or ring your family.
Yeah.
But you know, now there's just so much more going on.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. It's fast changing times, and you can notice it also with juniors a lot. But do you think that tennis, I mean, it's become so physical, so quick, so powerful. Do you think it can become more powerful, quicker? Will it get to a point where reach a limit and then something must change, like the rules must change to sort of, you know, just make it playable?
I don't think the rules will change, or I don't think the game will be impacted to that point where they have to do that, because everybody will be moving through at the same rate. So the game will change. I think we're seeing a lot more, big guys coming through 5 to 10 years ago. Guys, you know, like your Rajonic's, your Berdych's, you know, your Karlovic's, and just big serves, big ground strokes, and point was over. And I think the tennis hierarchy were a bit concerned, because generally those guys aren't very good to look at playing, and they're not very good to look at off court, just because they're just big guys, and I don't know, they just...
Yeah.
It just wasn't pretty tennis. And I could see... The data, I could gather from gathering the data, I could work out that it wasn't really going to get to that point. And what happened was it went through a phase where the game was going that way. And then I think the other players adjusted, you know, like your Rogers, your Raffers, your Novaks, your Andy. So they were returning better. They just worked out how to deal with it. And you know, now you look at the ideal athletes, you know, probably between 6'1 to 6'3. Anything over that, your mobility's too, and your movement's too restricted. You're a lot more prone to injury because you've got your lever lengths a lot longer, so the length between, you know, between joint to joint. And you're a bit more prone to stability and overuse injuries. So, I think the game, players are basically going to hit a certain point with the athletic development side of the game, which has still got a long, long way to go. I mean, we've probably got at least, I think, 10 or 15 years.
Really, 10, 15 years, we'll see. Will tennis in 15 years will look like tennis was for us now 20 years ago. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, I think someone like Novak would be, you know, who really has changed the game recently in the last recent 5 years. And he's turned, you know, what used to be defense, he's turned into attack. And it's just, you know, his speed, his mobility, his body, his ability to be able to slide on hard court and get into an aggressive shot and hit it where most people just would have been trying to get the ball back. And, you know, it's like Roger Bannister with the, you know, when he cracked the, what was it, the 4 minute mile or whatever it was. As soon as he did it, everybody else started doing it.
Okay.
And it's the same. It's the same with Novak. I think, you know, that game style, just as the younger players coming through, they're all doing that now. And then, okay, well, I need to be able to physically back it up. So everyone's looking for ways to be able to do that.
That's pretty amazing, because when you look at Djokovic now, I mean, as an athlete and the way he moves, you can't picture many people doing that. So. As you say, though, the youngsters coming through are maybe already doing that. In 10 years' time, that will be the norm, maybe. Who knows? But do you think
it's
also...
It's going to be interesting, mate. It's going to be interesting because I don't think, you know, when you look at the generations, I don't know how old your children are, if you have much to do with kids, but predominantly that's what I do now, is I work with athletes from 12 to... you know, 12 and above, but generally from 12 to 20.
Yeah.
So it's that real athletic development phase, just trying to teach them, you know, the do's and don'ts of life and of training and everything around it. And we're definitely seeing issues around players having the capacity to work hard sustainably.
Yes.
The mindset's not there.
The
tendency just to want to walk away and just think, well, I just don't want to go into that because it's too hard. And this is for players that are nationally ranked. It's not just players that, you know, aren't really that good.
I think, sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, sorry to interrupt. I agree with you completely there. And I think this is a different topic, which we could probably discuss a lot of as well. But I completely agree with you. I think the juniors and what you said earlier, as you said, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we didn't have all these distractions and like the media and the technology and so on. And I just somehow think I've said this before, is that in today's world, it's a given that a kid says wants something and he'll probably get it very quickly. It can also be just a question. The technology will give it back to you. So they're getting used to having everything immediately without going through the
generation.
Exactly, without going through the process. So, and you know, and tennis is such a, well, most sports, but okay, we're talking about tennis, is such a long process that it's going to be interesting what's going to happen with the juniors, because I do have sons who play in South Africa and we go to all the tournaments and blah, blah, blah. And I can just see it there. The passion is not really there. And, you know, it's one out of hundreds who really, you can see in his eyes, wants to do the work and, you know, can't wait to get on the court. And I think it's a bit worrying, but I think I've kind of noticed that's not. Initially, I thought it might be something to do with South Africa, but no, I've noticed it's just all over the world. So, yeah.
No, you're right. I remember Pat. I was chatting with Pat Rafter a couple of months ago, and I was talking to him about his time when he was running Australian men's tennis. So he did that for 5 years. He was running a Davis Cup and all the development programs. And he said he just got to the point where he just realized there was too much of a gap between himself and the younger generations, that he just couldn't bridge the mindset. And he didn't know how to deal with them and respond to them and try to, you know, get them motivated. Cause he was just like, well, if you guys want it, you're going to do the work, but You know, they'd go a certain, I guess they'd get to a certain point and then that was it, where he'd be like, go further, keep, push yourself or whatever the case. And he said to me, you know, it's not just Australia. It's you know, or he's talking to people, you know, obviously he's good friends with a lot of players and coaches and things. And he said, it's just, it's a global thing. And it's, is it an issue? Is it, you know, I think every generation that goes by has issues with the generations coming through because we're doing things, everyone's doing things differently. And so whether or not it's going to be an issue and how it affects the game, we don't know, but I don't know if participation's as high as it was two decades ago. And I think maybe that potentially combined with the lack of willingness to commit and push yourself, I think we're going to see probably less people playing at a high level, which, you know, ultimately is going to affect the players that reach the top.
No, it's going to be very interesting. Another thing I've heard a lot of players talk about and just wanted to see what you think is that there seems to be tennis nowadays, if you take probably the top 100, I mean, I'm plus minus, you know, they're all surrounded by a team nowadays. So it's not just their coach. As you know, they've got their, you know, physiotherapists, they've got their fitness coach, they've got maybe a dietitian, blah, blah, blah. You know, the list can go on. And you hear that many people who are playing tennis and trying to reach the top 100 and playing futures, for example, they say one of the biggest difficulties is they can reach that level, but the reason they don't reach it is because they don't have all this team around them that can help them to recover quickly, to play more tournaments and not be injured. So it's a kind of a catch-22. Only the ones that are maybe have the financial means or the ones that are supported by a federation or something seem to say, well, you know, that it's as simple as that. It's not anymore a question of how good I am at tennis, but there's all these other factors around them that really make it or don't make it for them. What do you think about that? Do you think that's quite true? Or
I think to answer that question in short, I'll give you a couple of examples in a moment, but to answer it in short, I think it comes down to the individual. And I think just like in anything in life, if you want something enough, I think you can make it happen. Okay. I think probably besides, you know, I mean, there's probably a lot of countries in the world that you could want it enough, but you can't get access to courts and you can't get equipment and those sorts of things. So, but I think for a majority of the world's population, I think particularly in the Western world, I think you've got an opportunity to make it in tennis, because generally what happens is you would turn up, you would show your interest, you'd be self-motivated, you'd get yourself there. People would buy into that. So whether it's a coach or a club owner, they would get you doing something, whether it's working, sweeping the courts, then you'll get some lessons. From there, that just gets fed and people will look after you. That's generally what I've found. So I'll give you two quick examples. So I won't mention these players' names, but there's two players that I've worked with in Australia recently. One of them was one of our top juniors last year, and I was helping him with his training and just trying to get some education into him. And I was actually blown away by this guy's work ethic, his dedication, his professionalism. After we trained about 10 times and we worked through, you know, food and he's warming up, he's cooling down, I pretty much said to him, mate, I think you're good to go. Like, I honestly think you've got your head around everything. You know what you have to do. And he's gone off and done it on his own. He gets no financial support. He's not from a wealthy family. And he's doing very, very well. Obviously, you know, he's before COVID hit. And even now he's still training his butt off and he's probably getting in front of a lot of players now because he's working harder than most people. So then there's, you know, that's one side of it. And he's come through with support from Tennis Australia, but I don't think it was over-the-top support. I think he's done a lot of it with his family and himself. And then I've got quite a few players that I've worked with globally that their parents answer questions for them, their parents buy them everything, their parents take them everywhere. You know, they're playing ITF tournaments. They're not winning a round in singles in months and months. And you've got to question whether that system works well. I don't think it necessarily is going to get you to the professional level if your parents have money. What's going to get you there is it's going to help if you've got the passion of to make it, and it overrides everything else.
Yeah,
and the money's there, then that's you've got a big step forward over someone who doesn't have the financial steed. But the passion is the biggest thing.
Okay, you must really want it. Okay, yeah, no, I agree with you. Great, Nathan. As I told you before that we started the podcast, I have a million questions. I'm going to really jump to the ones I wanted to ask you.
A lot quicker too,
because I don't want to keep you too long. But okay, you said you trained. We know you've trained a lot of top players, male and female, five number ones. Do you have any interesting stories? Can you tell us something like maybe that most people don't know? who was the one you enjoyed most training, if you can answer that?
Look, they're all, I think all of the players we've worked with at that level, they're all so different. You know, Martina Navratilova, she was just the ultimate professional. Great human being. You know, we lived with her for 2 years in Florida, and she taught us a lot about life. She's very ethical and, very, very smart person, very intelligent lady. So, look, it was interesting with Martina because she'd just come back out of retirement to play doubles. And she wanted to work hard and get her fitness up. So she was working hard, but she'd train, and then when she wasn't playing tennis or at the court, she wouldn't even know she played tennis. So she had the capability just to be able to switch off from the game, and I think that's what made her so successful.
Okay.
Other people just, you know, they're consumed by it. I mean, I worked with Leighton Hewitt for 10 years, and he's a very close friend of mine and someone that I admire for a lot of reasons. That his high level of professionalism used to blow me away. I mean, in 10 years, he was never late for one session. He never forgot a towel. He never forgot a water bottle. He always would say, I'm going to ring you up. He'd always ring you. Okay. And that just drives the quality of the team. Yeah, he's the leader, and he just drags you along with him. So, look, I love training him. We work so hard together, and, you know, he really just taught me how to fight, and you know, I had lots of funny moments with him training where, you know, we'd get stuck in situations, or we'd get lost because we went out running in the bush or something along those lines. Lots of stuff would happen in tournaments. There's always things happening in tournaments where people don't realize the situation where someone might walk out and, you know, have two different coloured socks on, and you're trying to run around and get their socks sorted out, and just funny things like that happen.
All right, okay. And did you also train Monica Seles?
Yes.
Yeah, and how was she?
Monica for 5 months, just before she retired. Oh, she was wonderful. She's a very private. Monica's very, very private person. Extremely respectful. So I met her through Martina Navratilova. They live close to each other, and I really enjoyed training Monica. She was such a sweetheart, but she was a fierce competitor. You'd see one side of her, and then you'd she was great. Yeah. She was great. Yeah. So, you know, I still to this day just think it's such a tragedy what happened to her with that incident where she got stabbed because she had so much more in front of her, and she just, you know, it was such a big challenge to come back from that. So I think you just learn a lot from all those players, because they're all so highly successful. But it's actually strange because they all do things quite differently to each other.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay, just goes to show that it doesn't matter who you are and what personality you're like and how tall you are, how fast you are, everyone's got a chance in tennis.
Okay, that's very that's very interesting. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah. So you must have also lived in Florida a while, obviously.
Yeah, well, there for 2 years.
Okay. How did you like it there? Was it nice?
Yeah, it was beautiful. We lived in a part of Florida that was there was a lot of retirees there, so it was quite slow paced. You know, everything was, all the restaurants were closed by 8 o'clock, and but it was a great place to train because it was always hot. We didn't get much rain, and we the roads were great. And we lived on a little island called Casey Key. Okay. And, you know, Martina had a boat and a jet ski, and we were right on the beach. So I love surfing and the ocean. So for me, it was a dream.
Okay. Great. From a completely different question I had here, because I wanted to know your opinion on this. Is there a lot of doping in tennis? It's a brutal sport. There's a lot of money, especially at the top. And we always hear about it. And there are people who obviously get caught. What's your, do you think there's still a lot of that going on in tennis?
Well, look, the fact that people have been caught, it shows you that it's, and, you know, it goes on. I think in any professional sport, and whenever there's money involved, there's going to be gambling and there's going to be doping and, you know, and and cheating at whatever capacity. I definitely have never ever seen or heard anybody talk about it. I never heard any players that I work with ever say, oh, that guy's taking something, or, and look, in tennis, you know, players can get away with certain things because everybody keeps their team so close. And I think if someone was going to do it, they'd be discussing it with people that they know and never ever going to mention it to anybody else. Look, I would say I'm probably 100% sure it goes on because, you know, over the last 10 years, there's been people who have been caught. So,
yeah,
you know, everyone's trying to find the edge.
I just personally think, and, you know, I'm not an athlete. I've never been, I can't even imagine what it means to be at that level. But, and that's probably the reason why, is already I find it a brutal sport physically. And you just see the amount of training and traveling and everything going on. And I just can't believe sometimes, you know, cyclists take it all the time, apparently, or used to, or whatever. But I just don't understand. You know, maybe tennis, there's a lot more money, so it doesn't really get talked about a lot. So I'm just very skeptical that these people can do what they're doing, you know, on consistently all year round. I don't know. That's just my point of view, but.
The nature of the game as well, I think it I think in some sports they probably need to look for those avenues a lot more than tennis, because tennis is quite technical as well. So, you know, generally a lot of sports that have a high technical capability, generally there's less prone to, you know, drug cheats. So, okay. I mean, I always categorize tennis as a combination of basketball and golf. where you need the technical and capabilities and ability to be able to absorb pressure in a certain moment, like hitting a golf swing to win a major or whatever the case. And you also need the physical capabilities of basketball, which is, you know, very power endurance based, which is what tennis is classified as. You know, and I'd be surprised if there's any golfers that take any performance enhancing sort of drugs like steroids and things like that. They might take stuff to help control with their nerves, better blockers and things like that. And I think, you know, tennis, I think there's probably going to be, you're always going to get, you know, cheats in any sport, and they'll do whatever they got to do. And I think that's just the numbers game. But I don't think across the board anyone would be looking or asking what else they can do. The players generally in tennis, where the main area that they need, when you get to the top level, everyone's pretty much as quick as each other. Everyone hits as hard as each other. They're all quite competitive physically in that regard. What the main, you know, differences is, it's comes down to strategy and how they can close a match out. And I don't think the drugs obviously have too much of an effect on that. And it's recovery as well. So if they are going to do anything, it's generally like recovery based, or players coming back from injury might look to do something to speed up their recovery by a few months. That's generally where people have been caught out.
Okay. Yeah, you've actually convinced me or answered a few of my questions. You've very well answered it. Changed my mind. I just want to go back to Australian tennis. We was talking about historically, you know, Australia's always had a great, a huge amount of good tennis players, blah, blah, blah. But right now, I just find it quite strange. I don't know, maybe you know them personally or something, but right now Australia's got, in my opinion, a pool of incredibly talented players. Kyrgios, Tomic, Kokkinakis, Alex de Minaur. I mean, they're all incredibly talented. People, I mean, Tomic and Kokkinakis can easily beat top 10s. We've seen that. Kyrgios as well. But somehow, we know, we kind of think that Kyrgios himself says he's not interested in becoming a top player because he says fitness-wise, he can't do it. And he's not interested in winning Grand Slams. I don't know. He's quite a character in that way. Tomic might have a lot of personal issues or family issues. And Kokkinakis seems to have injuries. You know, unfortunately, he seems to get injured all the time. The only one that seems to be doing quite well is Alex de Minaur. What's your opinion about that? Is that just unlucky that they're all in these different situations? Because they've got the talent. But you know, I don't see them winning a Grand Slam. Let's put it that way.
No, I mean, Alex has got a chance. You know, in a few years' time. Yeah. And obviously, probably. Nick has the talent to do it. I don't know where Tanasi's at physically, but I know he's had a lot of injuries. But he's obviously extremely talented himself. And Bernard, he could almost consider him now. He's just wasted talent. I don't think he's going to, you know, I don't even know how old he is. He'd be late 20s. And he's probably past it physically. And the fact that he's never had a big work ethic anyway, he's not going to probably pick that up now. And if he does, his body would probably fall apart. Okay. So I think he's out of the picture. I think he's run his race. And, you know, whether or not he was in tennis for the right reasons, well, you know, that's another story. Look, Nick is extremely talented. Nick is a lovely guy. He's believe it or not, he's one of the most liked guys on the tour.
Okay.
And he's quite respected because he speaks his mind and he calls out a lot of things, and it doesn't matter who they are. He'll still say, look, I think this is wrong. And he does a lot of things wrong as well in people's opinion. So he's a controversial character. And, you know, whether or not his comments about you know, he doesn't even like tennis and he doesn't care about winning Grand Slams, whether he just says that as a bit of a escapism or, you know.
He obviously does want to win a Grand Slam. I mean, let's be honest here.
Yeah. I'm sure if he did, he you know, maybe you'd never see him again. Who knows? But yeah, look, I think it's a generational issue, and whether it's just a generational issue in Australia. But look, I see a lot of younger players coming through, and one of my concerns was that these young
really
players.
Good ones?
Look, there's none that I think are going to be. I don't think we're looking at any Ash Barties or anything like that in the near future, but that's just looking at our junior players at the moment. But in saying that, a lot can happen in a couple of years. You know, when you think we've got Alex and Nick, and there's, you know, Johnny Millman, there's James Duckworth, there's Jordan Thompson. We've got like a lot of players, and then in the women's side, we've got, you know, I'm not sure, but I think there's about 3 to 5 in the top 100 as well. So when you're considering we've got probably, you know, 6 to 8 guys in the men's and the same in the women's, you know, we're taking up 8% of the top 100, which is not a bad ratio. We just don't have anyone in the men's that's dominating. Well, when you look, we've got the number one player in the females. The country's still doing pretty well.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't even mention her. I kind of forgot her, but, you know, obviously number one in the world, So, I mean, that's pretty amazing, yeah.
But the boys, look, it's hard to pinpoint. I've done a bit of work with the guys, but I don't really know them too personally. And once again, it comes back to the same thing that Pat Rafter said. It's just a so much disparity between generations. You need to start with these players when they're young. If you can't get them when they're young and they're just doing what they want and they get to the 18, 19-year-old bracket and they start making money and travelling on their own, it's very hard to try and influence them in a good way. And, you know, in saying that, you know, it's just about being happy. He might be happy living the way he is and doing what he wants. Yeah. And, you know, I call Nick the anti-professional. and, you know, to get where he's got with what he does, it's crazy, but I take my hat off to him. Like, he does work hard. You don't fall on top of the mountain. You know, he's got himself up there and he's there, and he, in some respect, he's entitled to do what he wants to do. But my concern was always that with comments that sometimes he makes and guys like Bernard's attitude, that reflects onto the younger generations, but we're actually not seeing that in Australia. Like, from all the junior tournaments and the players that I work with, they're highly professional. They actually don't look at those guys as role models. They look more at, you know, your Novaks, your Rafas, your Zarevs. which is interesting.
Okay. It's, yeah, global sport, I think. It's not a team. Nathan, I'll finish there, but I have a last section, which will be quick.
Sure.
I do a rapid fire.
All
kinds of questions just to get to know you a little bit better. But before I start these, do you actually play tennis? I just need to know that.
I do play a little bit, yes.
Okay. Just for fun. Okay. All right, no problem. Okay, let's start. Okay, what's your very first memory as a child of tennis?
Watching the Australian Open on TV.
Okay. If you have to define to us what type of tennis player you are, how would you define yourself?
I'm a hacker.
Okay. What's your best shot?
My best shot would be, once I'm warmed up, would definitely be my forehand down the middle of the court.
Keep it safe.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Did you have a tennis idol growing up or not really?
Yeah, I did. I loved, I had a couple, but early on, I really liked Andre Agassi. And then, even though he's not much older than me, Pat Rafter.
Okay. Any current players, male or female, that you really, really like watching or just like?
There's one for me that stands out above everybody else by a long way, and it's Novak, because I think he flies on his own. He does okay. things totally different to the others. He's when you dig around about how he has his life structured, where he's at now. I don't know where he was, you know, in the past, but where he is now. He's done a lot of work on his mindset. He's into his meditation, and they're all things that I'm a big believer in.
Okay, yeah, that's another one of my questions that I skipped, but let's leave that, the meditation and all that. If you have to list the big three tennis players from favorite to least favorite.
Okay. Well, I can't go past my boy Leighton Hewitt at number one.
No. The big three as in Djokovic, Nadal, Federer.
Oh, okay. Well, Novak, Rafa and Roger.
Rafa and Roger. Okay. Best tournament in the world?
Wimbledon.
Favorite court that you've ever been to?
I'd say Wimbledon Show Court.
Okay. Do you have a favorite or pair of tennis shoes?
No.
Do you have a favorite all-time racket?
I've got a couple of rackets that I don't actually use, but they're all signed, autographed. So I've got them actually up in the office framed.
Okay.
And I don't have one that I use. I normally just go and grab anyone.
Okay.
But my favorite racket would probably be one of Martina Navratilova's rackets, because I think we've got one that she used in her when she won the Australian Open mixed doubles, which when she won that match, she became, or she won, that was every Grand Slam she'd won. So she'd won singles, mixed and doubles in every slam.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's nice. If you have to book a restaurant and invite three players, male or female, any era, which restaurant would you book and which players?
Yeah. All right. So there's this restaurant in a part of Australia in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And it's called Jimmy's Greek Tavern.
Okay.
And it's one of my favorite restaurants in the world. It's very old school. The food's fantastic. The service is very loud, and it's a very basic restaurant, always very busy. And I've had some good memories there with Leighton and our team. And I would probably invite Andre Agassi.
Yeah.
Two players or three?
No, three. Yeah.
Three.
Yeah.
So I'd invite Novak, Andre Agassi, and Leighton. So Leighton would help me, because I'd be a bit starstruck probably with Andre there. So he would help just navigate the conversations.
And who would pay the bill?
Oh, probably Leighton. He's pretty generous.
Is he? And a Greek restaurant, usually there's a lot of plate smashing. Do you think Novak get him a bit worked up? Do you think he?
I think Novak would just do it for the fun of it.
Okay. But, you know, Andre, a very.
Andre would be a bit shy, but I think he'd probably break one, and Leighton would probably just smash him.
But, you know, a very interesting thing. I've only made, I don't know, about 8 interviews or something like that. And when I ask restaurant, I'm not joking to you, the tennis players or anybody involved in tennis, I'd say...
Says Greek.
It's unbelievable. It's always Greek. I mean, Greek food's fantastic, but it's just really weird. Anyway, that's interesting. Do you like cooking?
I love cooking. I do the majority of the cooking at home.
Okay. Favorite food?
All of it. I like crossing borders. I don't eat a lot of seafood. But anything besides that, I love. I'm not into exotic, weird things like eating fish eyes and, you know, innards and things like that. You know, some Eastern or Asian delicacies, but I keep it simple. And I love all my fruits and vegetables and any kind of protein. And yeah, love it. Love grains. Yeah.
Everything. Do you like pizza? Do you have a favorite pizza?
I like homemade pizza. So mm-hmm. I like a good quality pizza. I think pizza for me is like chocolate. If I'm going to mm-hmm. eat it, I want to eat, you know, very good quality. And that way you generally tend to have less of it as well. So I love making homemade pizzas and putting on it good quality ingredients.
Are you one of those who puts pineapple and banana on a pizza?
No, I wouldn't do that. No fruit on a pizza. You can't do that.
Okay, good. I'm happy to hear that. Do you have a favorite band or singer?
I've got a band, favorite band, but a lot of people probably wouldn't have heard of them. They're called Need to Breathe. If you haven't, you should check them out. They're an awesome band. American.
Need to Breathe.
Need to Breathe, yeah.
Okay, all right. Check them out.
And favorite artists, well, there's a guy in Australia. You probably mm-hmm. wouldn't have heard him. His name's Guy Sebastian.
I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, he's one of our biggest musicians at the moment. I love his music. It's very heartfelt, and he sings about things that are relevant to me as well, family and life and just getting through things.
Do you have a favorite movie?
Favorite movie? Yeah, I do. One always comes to mind, but definitely not my favorite, but I can never get it out of my head, and it's Shawshank Redemption.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that pops up often.
I can't think of anything else, but I know that's not my favorite, but I'm going to have to run with it.
Yeah. Do you enjoy TV series?
I only ever watch on TV a few things. One is sport, and the only sport I watch is rugby league and tennis and UFC.
Okay.
And aside from that, I only really watch documentaries.
Okay.
I don't like watching sitcoms and series because they just, for me, they're just not teaching me anything. They're just taking up headspace. And I'm not saying if people love them, there's definitely nothing wrong with that. This is just for me. I like to watch something that I'm going to learn something from, or particularly I like watching documentaries that are going to inspire me, make me feel good, or make me want to be better.
Okay. No, that's good. Do you have any hobbies that are quite particular? Something?
Yeah, I like surfing.
Yeah.
Anything to do in the ocean. I just love being in the ocean. I live right on the beach. I'm in the ocean every day, no matter what it's like. I go in either surfing or go for a swim. My other hobbies would probably be just health, just trying to live as healthy as I can. And I know that sounds cliche from a trainer, but for me, it's not looking like, you know, Chris Hemsworth or, you know, looking like a model. I love exercise. I love how it makes me feel. And I love being healthy. My training philosophy has changed so much over the last 10 years, away from just having a total exercise mindset to now having a lot more holistic mindset. Mm. So the exercise is just a small part of it now.
The whole thing.
Just the whole process. So, you know, like I said before, just going through my morning rituals and working on self-development and trying to make myself happy as I can.
Do you, what star sign are you? Do you believe in that?
I don't believe in it, no.
You don't? Okay. Well, do you know what star sign you are?
I know what I am, but I don't even, yeah, I'd never even practice that. I get all the bulk of my motivation and my values from my faith in God, from Christianity. And that's what I pretty much stem my foundation of my life off.
Okay. Do you have a favorite country?
Favorite country?
Can't be Australia.
Oh, look, I lived in Spain for 2 years.
Okay.
And I absolutely loved it there.
You went at the Casal Sanchez Academy. All right.
It was.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved it there. It was one of my favorite times of my life. I'd probably say there, or I know this is part of America, but I'd consider it its own country, is Hawaii.
Okay. Yeah. Apparently very beautiful.
Yeah.
Then do you think tennis is the most difficult sport in the world when you consider all the aspects to it? Or do you 100%. Think there's something more difficult? You think so? Yeah.
No. Okay. No. Okay. No way. No way. So like I said before, when you're combining the physical capabilities of basketball with golf, and to be the best, you know, or the top 100 in those, in combining those two sports together, you can imagine how difficult that is.
Yeah. Okay, we're nearly finished. This one's called the Super Tiebreak. 10 questions. You must complete your perfect all-time player. Can be male, female, any era. Let's start with the serve.
Serve. Oh, I don't think you could go. Oh, look, I'm going to go with Pat Rafter because I loved his serve, because of the way he had allowed him to play his game. So he didn't have a big serve, but it was all about placement for him. So it was about, I'm going to put the ball here. And he planned his shot off his serve. And that's what I loved. He wasn't just saying, I'm going to tee it down the middle and hope it goes in and hope I ace them.
Okay.
His serve was all about strategy.
Return.
I'll go Agassi.
Forehand.
Roger. Federer.
Backhand.
I'll go Hewitt.
Volley.
Oh, I've got to go Roger.
Drop shot.
Drop shot. Oh, Nick Kyrgios.
Well, that's a good one. Movement.
Movement. There's so many good movers. Actually, like someone who I consider to be like one of the purest movers. I mean, I don't think you could go past Roger Federer, and then I think Andy Murray. Andy was extremely dynamic. And then for court coverage, I think in their prime, I couldn't go past Leighton Hewitt.
Yeah. Mentality, as in, you know, strong mentality.
Oh, Rafa.
Rafa, yeah, usually he pops up. Overall style.
Federer.
And personality.
Personality. I haven't said any females. I've just said males. personality. I think I'd have to go, you know, early in their career, I think Novak Djokovic, when he was young and he was playful and remember, he was always taking off all the players' serves and,
he was doing imitations.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's got a bit more serious. He's got a bit more serious as he's got older.
Okay. Great. That's a nice one. And the last one, you must ask yourself a question and answer it.
All right, I'm going to ask myself, Nathan, if you had to leave one message for the listeners, what would it be? And my answer is going to be, if you want to get the most out of yourself as a tennis player, you need to look at, step back and look at what's involved with the game. So not only the exercise and the on-court work, but also the preparation and recovery, hydration, nutrition. And you don't have to be treat yourself like a professional to maximize those areas. You just need to be conscious and make the right decisions at the right time that you know are going to affect your performance or your longevity in the game. So just think a bit more holistic about the game, not just keeping it all just on court, hitting more balls. We know from, you know, history isn't the answer. It's a combination of doing all the right things.
Okay. Fantastic. Nathan, that's it. I'm sure you're happy that it's finished.
That was great.
I really enjoyed it. And I can hear, you know, you've got tons of interesting things to talk about. And I agree with a lot of things you say. Yeah. So, I mean, I'd love to maybe talk to you again also sometime, but that's yeah. I think enough for today. And thanks a lot. And probably speak to you soon again.
My pleasure, mate. My pleasure. And just to all the listeners, just wishing everyone all the best during these challenging times. And, you know, the best thing we can do is stick together and reach our hands out where we can. And don't be afraid to ask for help too. So, yeah, thank you for your time. And hopefully some of the information I shared will help some people.
Fantastic. Great. Thanks, right, Nathan. Mate. Have a good
Take
evening.
Care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Cheers. Cheers.